Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
Developing Space Food and how the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation helps up-and-coming STEM students. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Astronauts gotta eat. From 10-day moon missions like Artemis 2 to months-long stays on the International Space Station, there's a lot that goes into thinking about what foods might work for those astronauts. That includes dietary needs and how space food tastes. We'll speak with NASA scientist Ryan Dowdy about how food is selected for space missions. Then, the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation was founded by some of the original members of the Mercury 7. The goal was to give out merit-based scholarships for STEM education. That work continues today, and one recipient recently flew to the moon. We'll speak with the foundation's president and CEO, Colleen Middlebrooks, about the role the foundation is playing in the future of space exploration. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Astronauts have far more appetizing choices these days when it comes to food during their space missions. Early human spaceflight was limited to things like tubed food. Now astronauts on the Artemis II mission had more than 189 items to choose from to eat in flight.
In space, you really just eat all of your food out of bags of some kind, plastic bags or little metallic bags, because we have to rehydrate a lot of our food. This is actually shrimp cocktail. And this has been rehydrated already, so we added water to it, and the shrimp soaked back up the water, and it's actually pretty tasty. This is an example of a food that has not been rehydrated yet. It got all dried out for flying up here in space, and those are green beans. So we do have to eat our vegetables even in space, but don't worry, they do give us mac and cheese.
Developing a space food menu is complex and requires the consideration of both nutrition and taste. Here to talk more about space food is Ryan Dowdy. He's a NASA scientist and founder and CEO at Ready Bar. Ryan, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thanks so much for having me, Brendan.
Ryan, we're here to talk about space food, and I think we all were captivated by the Artemis II mission, especially that kind of that meme of Nutella floating by in the Orion space capsule. But I know that the Artemis astronauts didn't just eat Nutella their entire 10-day mission. What do Artemis astronauts eat?
Oh my gosh, they had an amazing menu. They had 189 different items that were pulled from the menu of the International Space Station. So I worked at NASA 2014 to 2021. I managed all the food for the International Space Station. And we had an enormous menu for the ISS of coffee, tea, pineapple drink, apple cider, lemonade, broccoli au gratin, spicy green beans, macaroni and cheese. There's an enormous amount of foods that they were able to use for the Artemis mission that they literally pulled directly from the International Space Station menu that we've been running, you know, for the last 20 years. So they had a really great menu. And I was really excited to see that the Artemis menu included a lot of the new foods that we added to NASA's menu in the last 5 years. So the funny thing about the International Space Station menu is that all the research and development dollars to develop it came from NASA in the mid-1980s, and all these foods were developed in Texas. So the foods are meatloaf, mac and cheese, mashed potatoes, green beans, vanilla pudding. I came on and started managing the food system for the International Space Station, and all the astronauts were saying, Ryan, this has to change. So the problem was that NASA didn't have additional R&D money. So what we did was my team, which was operations for the ISS, worked with the food R&D team, and we pulled on some of these new menu items, like more coffee, more tea, more fish, fruits, and vegetables. And I was really excited to see those same items end up on the Artemis II mission.
Let's talk about how you get from the kind of meatloaf and casserole of the 1980s menu to what we have now. What is the starting point? Did you just go to the astronauts and say, what do you want to eat? Or was it NASA saying, hey, these are only the foods that you can use, figure out how to make it better?
Great question. It's actually both. So we work with both the crew in terms of they sample everything that we're developing in terms of R&D, and then they score everything onto a 1 to 9 scale. If it's below 6, it doesn't fly. One of our sayings at NASA was, if you wouldn't feed this to your grandmother, do not try and feed it to an astronaut because they're not going to eat it. So we worked with the crew to make sure that they liked it, but we also worked with the nutrition lab because we realized that once we looked at the entire food system and analyzed how astronauts were getting their vitamins and minerals, that they really needed to be getting the vitamins and minerals from the food that they were eating. So we started to add a lot more fish, fruits, and vegetables to the menu. So fish, fruits, and vegetables are huge categories. So the R&D team picked several items and started saying, what can we freeze dry? What would freeze dry really well? Or what can we put in a thermostabilized pouch, a little can pouch? And we tested all those products, saw how the astronauts liked them, and then made sure that they were both nutritious and delicious, because that's the key.
What have you found makes a meal or a food or a snack score high on that 1 to 9 score? What is it that the astronauts really want their food to have?
The most surprising thing that astronauts want their food to have is that they want it to remind them of home. And the biggest thing that we learned from early food days at NASA during the Mercury missions and Apollo, there was a lot of tubes and cubes. It was like Willy Wonka food that was compressed into a cube, and it was all about minimal risk to, you know, having something crumble or shatter, or, you know, you inhale crumbs, any of that. It was minimal risk. And then what we've learned over time is that crew members, they don't want tubes and cubes. They want to eat with a knife, a fork, and a spoon, and they want foods that remind them of home. So that's one of the biggest driving factors for how astronauts score food is, does this look and taste like real food that you would have on Earth? And funny story, we've actually never flown freeze-dried ice cream to the International
Come on,
Space
that's what we all think of.
I know, it sells really well, but it's actually never been flown. We did fly a lot of real ice cream on the Dragon rockets when there was room in the freezer on the way up, because a lot of times on the way back down, science samples that need to be frozen will get sent back down, but on the way up, sometimes that payload is empty. So we were able to add in ice cream that we literally bought locally in Florida, wiped it down to make sure that there was no bacteria on the outside of it, put it in the freezer, and launched it up to the ISS.
What flavor?
Oh, gosh. It totally depends. I'll tell you, we used a lot of the flavor depends on the crew that's up there. But what we would send is, do you know the little small, it's almost like a kid's cup. We would send kids' cups amounts because there's no large freezer. There's no freezer chest on the ISS. I mean, shoot, there's not even a large refrigerator because there's not enough electricity on the ISS to support that and taking care of the crew at the same time, which is why the majority of food on the ISS is shelf stable. So the type of ice cream, small amounts, always small amounts so that you can eat it in one go.
Did you leave the little wooden spoon with it, or did they have their own spoons up there to eat it?
They had a funny story. They had all their own spoons. And what's funny about the silverware for the International Space Station is that it's changed in the past 5 years. So when I started at NASA, we were still sending the silverware from the shuttle missions to the International Space Station. During shuttle, NASA had bought thousands and thousands of knives, forks, and spoons that were magnetic, and they would stick to the trays that the crew members on shuttle would strap to their knee. And so we still had thousands of pieces of silverware that literally had the word shuttle engraved on them. And I can't tell you how many times ISS astronauts walked up to me and said, hey, you guys know you don't have to engrave shuttle on the silverware anymore, right? I said, yes, I know. But what was funny is while I was there, we actually ran out of all the shuttle silverware and we had to come up with new silverware. So we came up with a new silverware set that the crew members really liked. And we sent that to space. So we've got new knives, forks, and spoons that no longer say shuttle. And as a matter of fact, they don't say ISS either. It's just the NASA logo. See, you never know. Just the thing is, government procurement, it happens like once every 5 or 10 years. You got to buy stuff that lasts. I guarantee you they were using that silverware on Artemis as well, because it just has the NASA logo. Like, we need to move away from, you know, program specific. Oh, this was shuttle silverware. You never hear the end of it.
I love that. That's fantastic. You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We are talking food in space and silverware with Ryan Dowdy. He's a NASA scientist and founder and CEO at Ready Bar. Ryan, I want to go back to the tubes and cubes thing you mentioned. You know, that was for Mercury, Gemini, Apollo. These NASA astronauts later on wanted more food that reminded them of home. Was that because of the duration that they were staying in space? I'm thinking of, you know, shuttle missions got a little bit longer than Mercury and Gemini missions, and then International Space Station stays 6 months at a time. Is that what the desire was for food from home?
You got it. The food system changes to match the mission requirements. And like you're saying, we started with, you know, missions that were hours or days. And let me give you an example. The Army has studied how long warfighters can eat MREs, meals ready to eat. And they can only eat MREs for about 10 days straight before they get something called palate fatigue. Their body's just tired of eating it because it looks and tastes the same from meal to meal. So using that research, NASA found that if we're going to keep crew members in space for longer than 10 days, you can't just feed them MREs. You need to actually feed them food that looks like food, and you need a really large, diverse menu. Because what the data shows is that if crew members don't have enough variety in the food system, they literally stop eating, they lose muscle mass, they lose bone density, and they're not able to do really important things like go on EVAs. So the food system is the first countermeasure towards all the bad things that space does to your body. And 6 month stays on the ISS require that 200 plus item menu that we had on the ISS.
Ryan, you mentioned with this newer food, you know, there's been a focus on putting kind of these nutrients and minerals in it to make sure that they're getting those from their diet. I'm wondering how much attention food scientists pay to those macronutrients, the caloric intake, your protein, your carbohydrates. I say this as someone whose personal trainer makes me track all of my macros. You know, how much goes into that you're looking to make sure that they are getting specifically what they need?
Enormous amount of work. The nutrition lab at Johnson Space Center, run by Scott Smith, does a phenomenal job of tracking the nutrients in all the foods, also putting together requirements for what astronauts need in terms of macros and in terms of calories. And the food system is designed to deliver that. So we paid very, very close attention to the nutrition that the crew was getting. And what was interesting when I came on was that the nutrition actually wasn't the problem in terms of macros. It was actually the micronutrients that was really important. And the research pointed to, you know, all the bad things that space does to your body. A lot of that can be counteracted by eating a diet that has omega-3s and antioxidants. And where do you find omega-3s and antioxidants in human food? You find it in fish, fruits, and vegetables. So we started putting items on the menu like types of fish that were really high in omega-3s. We started putting on fruits and vegetables that, you know, we had, it wasn't enough to just have, let's say, a pouch of, you know, tropical fruit, the Dole tropical fruit cups. So it wasn't enough, you know, it wasn't enough to have that. What we wanted to do is we realized these items, you know, they were developed a while ago and they tended to be in sugar syrup. So what we would do is, you know, we would make a mango salad and then the R&D team would freeze dry that. And why hadn't it been done before? Well, nobody was eating freeze-dried, you know, rehydrated mangoes in Texas in 1985. It just was a part of it. But the thing is, people's tastes change over time. And so we found that the crew, which is, you know, literally our age, is eating a lot more fish, fruits, and vegetables. And it's not just beef and potatoes anymore. And so the crew is paying a lot of attention to their health. They're paying a lot of attention to their macros and a lot of attention to their micros.
That was Ryan Dowdy, a NASA scientist and founder and CEO at Ready Bar. Our conversation about the development of space food continues next week on Are We There Yet? Stay listening. But still to come, how a decades-long organization is supporting the next generation of space explorers.
We'll have about 80, close to 80 scholars this year in this year's class, and they receive up to $15,000 apiece. And it's all merit-based, and it's for juniors and seniors in college in STEM fields.
A look at the work of the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. For over four decades, the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation has awarded scholarships to students in support of STEM education, including Artemis II astronaut Christina Cook. It was established by the original Mercury 7 astronauts. With over 55 university partners, the organization aims to help students reach new heights by awarding merit-based scholarships to students in STEM fields. Here to talk more about the foundation and its purpose is Colleen Middlebrooks, the president and CEO of the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation. Colleen, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thank you so much.
The organization is over four decades old. Let's start with the what of it. What is the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation and why was it created in the first place?
That's a very good question. Good place to start. We are 41 years old, founded by the Mercury 7 astronauts. There were six at the time that were alive and one spouse. And they started thinking about how to leave a legacy. And they determined that they wanted to focus on U.S. STEM education. And so amongst the seven of them, they picked six universities and seven scholars. And each of those received $1,000 each, which back in 1986 is when they first gave out the first one. But the idea formed in 84. And it has actually grown to almost, we'll have about 80, close to 80 scholars this year in this year's class. And they receive up to $15,000 apiece. And it's all merit-based. And it's for juniors and seniors in college in STEM fields. So it's really grown exponentially.
I'm thinking back to the foundation of this in the mid-80s. This is a time when there was really a focus on science in spaceflight, right? I mean, this is when we're starting to see mission specialists on the space shuttle being selected because of their science background. You know, was that kind of the nexus of this, or really what was the motivations behind them to start it?
I think that was part of it. I think they were just very committed to the United States becoming and remaining a leader in all things STEM. So that was really where the heart of it was. And obviously that's continued on. But you're right, things did start to change with missions, and there was a lot of specialty experiments and things going on, and still are on the space station.
With these scholars now, is the focus specifically on STEM when it comes to space, or are we looking at still STEM across the board?
That is actually a very good question. I should have led with that, because the name of the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation is quite misleading. Out of the almost 1,000 scholars that we've had, only two have become astronauts. So it is on, they're, you know, discovering cures for cancer and doing all sorts of other exciting things with propulsion. And only two have become astronauts. But I think for us right now, the most exciting piece of that is that one of those astronauts was Christina Koch, who just came back with Artemis II. So there's been a lot of celebrating and full circle sort of vibes going on around here.
I'll tell you what, 2 out of 1,000 for an astronaut is actually very good statistics, and one of them has been to the moon. So,
yeah, we're really doing a good job right now.
Yeah, I don't think that's bad at all, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah, talk about how this is merit based. What are some of the things that you're looking for when you're making these selections? And pardon me if you've already said this. How many do you select a year for a scholarship?
Well, to be quite honest, because I'm new, I'm actually right in the thick of the scholar selection process. So we have 55 partner universities, and at each university, it varies based on funding. Some universities have one scholarship available. Some have two or three. They're funded by family foundations, corporations, astronauts themselves, and some of the universities do a match so that we can have two at the university. So there's a liaison at each university. They sort of conduct their own search and committee, and they narrow it down, and then they serve to us their top candidates. And we have a collection of astronauts, alumni scholars, educators, and our staff, and we go through those finalists and determine who will receive the scholar award. And they will all find that out at the end of May. So right now we have funding and for, I said, about 78. Sometimes it's so close that we've had a donor step up and say, I'll just support one more, you know, because they're just too good. And I have found with reading through them, they're such top-notch people. And, you know, they're doing great things with research, but they're also, they can play the piano, and they're serving in community service aspects around, you know, around their university. And it's very hard right now to determine who's the best of the best.
You said that they get picked in May, there's also quite a big event happening for the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation in May, right? Can you tell us a bit about what's on the horizon and what those scholars can expect?
Well, May is a busy month for us because we have our programmatic mission part going on with scholar selection, but we also are in a contract with Kennedy Space Center and NASA, and we oversee the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame. So that takes place at Kennedy Space Center on May 16th. And it's a ceremony during the day at the visitor complex. And then there's a gala that evening under Apollo Saturn V. And we typically have close to 400 guests, lots and lots of astronauts, mostly shuttle at this point. And we're going to be honoring Joe Tanner and Tom Akers, who each went on multiple missions, did EVAs, you know, did all the things up in space, and much deserved. And side note that the inductees then feed into the Heroes and Legends exhibit that's at the visitor complex. So it's sort of a process we manage, but then we serve it up and then it becomes part of an exhibit.
And then in parallel, the scholars are notified whether or not they've received
right? When we catch a breath on the 17th of May, when everything's done, a week later, all of the notifications are going out. And one thing I wanted to say about our scholar award is that not only are they receiving their merit money up to $15,000, in that packet they receive, they are invited free of charge to come meet as a cohort. So the whole class of 2026 will meet in Houston in August, and we treat them to a weekend of going to the Space Center out there, meeting our astronauts, presenting their research, and celebrating that they are now this new class of scholars. From there, they can be mentored through their whole life. You know, they can receive different types of support throughout their professional journey. And at this point, because we're 41 years old, we have alumni scholars that serve on our board. We have ones that are donors. So it's like a little mini university. But I think the biggest takeaway is we're not just giving them a check and sending them on their way. They're part of our family, as we like to say.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Colleen Middlebrooks. She's the president and CEO of the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation. Colleen, you mentioned one of your, we'll say, pretty well-known alumni from the Scholarship Foundation, Christina Cook, who was on the Artemis II mission. That mission really kind of captivated the public in a way that I wasn't expecting. There was a lot more people that were paying attention to space than I'm used to. I noticed a lot of people talking about how, oh, they're looking for jobs in NASA now and they want to do this. Are you expecting kind of an Artemis bump with people that are going to be applying for this scholarship? Because now they want to do the cool things that Christina Cook and her crewmates did.
I was just having lunch with one of our board members and we were talking about that. And I certainly think it's been an infusion. I think, you know, the space station was going on and there have been manned launches, but this was far more iconic in a lot of ways and really had the whole world watching, and certainly because of the mission they were on and what they aimed to do on it. But I do think it's a shot in the arm. You know, I'm hopeful that their cadence will continue with the next missions and that'll just continue to have people be more excited about the future of space.
So are you going to need more reviewers then? You're expecting more applications.
Right? Yeah, I know. There's no telling now. A cat's out of the bag. Yeah. But, you know, Christina and Victor Glover actually have been active with us. And now they're going to be quite busy. But we're hoping over time, you know, they'll find time to join us again with our scholars at Innovators or at Hall of Fame.
I've been seeing quite a few videos of Christina out there talking about how she was an astronaut scholarship recipient, which is very, very cool. You have only been in this position, I know, for less than a year, but is there any previous scholar that really stands out, Christina Cook aside, that is doing some really interesting stuff that you would like to highlight?
Yes, I would. And I'm not going to do a good job pronouncing her last name, but we have a scholar, alumni scholar named Fiona. She is actually in mission control. And so during Artemis II, we had girl power going to around the moon and girl power in mission control. So for me, that's been coolest thing in 9 months. I mean, I guess I couldn't have joined Astronaut Scholarship Foundation at a hotter time or better time. But there's been so many accomplished scholars. They've invented things. We actually have support if they want to get a patent for something. So over the years, there's been a lot of successes. Like I said, some are even donors now because they've done so well with some of the things they've invented. I don't have another name off the top of my head right now. I'm still trying to learn the class of 2025.
Well, there's quite a few of them, right?
Yeah, there was 74 of them. So I've met a good many of them at various universities, but I'm still learning.
You mentioned girl power and mission control there. And I know that there has always been kind of this challenge with diversifying the STEM field and getting different people in there. What role do you see the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation in diversifying the field of STEM, not only in gender, but also in economic status or race or background?
I'm actually really glad you asked that. We are very proud to say that at this time, when we award our scholars, we're pretty neck and neck, male, female. So it's 48, 52, whatever. It's been very, very similar. It's not lopsided one way or the other. But for me, the addition in recent years of, we have four HBCUs that currently hold our scholarship and some with multiple at their school. And for me, that's been a very important part of our diversification. I want to continue on that track, and the board's committed to that. And again, it's there's just so many wonderful students at so many universities. So we're committed to continue to diversify on that level.
Finally, Colleen, for people that are not planning to go to college or may have been beyond college and not astronauts, how can they get involved in the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation?
One of the single best ways to get involved is to become a mentor. So we have about 160 in our mentor pool that are providing mentorship, but we're always looking for all kinds of various fields. And that's like a once a month commitment. If you want to do more, you can, but that's a very important part of this. And you can find that information at our website, which is just astronautscholarship.org. Other ways, of course, is to donate, support STEM. You know, if we're doing an award ceremony at a university near where you live, which UCF, Florida Tech and Embry-Riddle are Florida-based university partners, but come out to one, meet an astronaut and see what we're doing, meet our scholars, and you'll see why, you know, this continues to grow and why I'm proud to be a part of it.
And I will have you back on when inevitably your next scholar gets named as a NASA astronaut, right?
Yes, yes. I'd love to come back.
Colleen Middlebrooks is the president and CEO of the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation. Colleen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of this show or you want to join us as a guest, well, reach out. We're at arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.